Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Most of the globe was drier than normal in 2021, with cascading effects on economies, ecosystems and our daily lives, the UN World Meteorological Organization, or WMO, said on Tuesday. According to the agency's first report on global water resources, areas that were unusually dry included South America's Rio de la Plata area, where a persistent drought has affected the region since 2019. In Africa, major rivers such as the Niger, Volta, Nile and Congo had below average water flow in 2021. The same trend was observed in rivers in parts of Russia, West Siberia and in Central Asia. On the other hand, there were above normal river volumes in some North American basins, the North Amazon and South Africa, as well as in China's Amur River Basin and northern India. WMO said that 3.6 billion people have inadequate access to water at least 1 month per year, and that this is expected to increase to more than 5 billion by 2050. To Uganda, where humanitarians fear that services for refugees may be overwhelmed by the arrival of displaced people from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, DRC, and South Sudan. Issuing the alert on Tuesday, UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, said that 130,000 people have fled violence in the DRC and South Sudan this year alone. Uganda already hosts 1.5 million refugees, and services are bursting at the seams. UNHCR's Young Algadini Williams said that at one health center, health professionals see up to 80 patients a day.
The inpatient facilities were teeming with people. In the child pediatric center, there were so many children that many of the parents and the children were sleeping on the floor.
Uganda is one of UNHCR's most underfunded operations, with just 46% of its appeal for $343 million received this year. The shipping industry must invest urgently in sustainability if it's to withstand future shocks and help to prevent another global cost of living crisis, UN Trade and Development experts UNCTAD said on Tuesday. In a new report on maritime transport, the UN agency noted that between 2020 and 2021, carbon emissions from the world's maritime fleet increased by almost 5%. At the same time, UNCTAD said that the average age of the ships in service has increased to almost 22 years. Replacing them is key to ensuring that the maritime industry's transition to a low-carbon future happens, said UNCTAD Secretary-General Rebecca Greenspan, who called for predictable global rules to support the industry, ports and ship owners. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Imperio San Francisco by Gray Brecken.
At the turn of the century, the novelist Frank Norris wrote a great novel called The Octopus about the battle between the railroad and the so-called farmers. And he says in that book, farming as it is practiced in California is simply another extension of mining. Now they were mining the soil. And it was the same thing. He called it the true California spirit. After us, the deluge. They didn't care, he said.
On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
That's right. That's coming up in the second hour. Maria Gillard's outstanding TUC Radio. It's part two, so you can go back to your to our archives. It's not that hard on the webpage, Voice of Kansas, Radio Free Kansas, Voice of Kansas on Blog Talk Radio. You can go back, and last week's Tuesday was part one. I'm so tempted to play the complete one, part one and two on a special show because it's so incisive, it's so intelligent, it's so Maria Gillard finds some of the most great stuff to broadcast. I can't do it. Coming up next is the latest headlines from Democracy Now! This morning, and then we have Alex Smith. I apologize. Oh, by the way, I apologize for being late today. We had a small technical emergency, and I had to do it. I had to do this. I had to take care of it. And I'm usually very punctual about our noon broadcast because I am broadcast. Ideally, I set this thing up to give the common people, the workers, time on their lunch break to catch the world news, because most people cannot catch it who have to work for a living. They just can't get it. In the morning, they're busy. They're making their lunches. They're getting their cars ready for the commute. It's just unending headaches in the morning. It's very difficult. So I originally, 20 years ago, was it 20? Well, 2007, so not quite 20. Well, at least 10 years ago, I decided to broadcast at the lunch hour so that workers could take a break and put on their phones and listen to the world headlines, know what's going on. That's what it's about. So coming up, Democracy Now!, followed by Alex Smith's Radio EcoShock, which gives you from the world's largest archive of environmental radio shows, the latest science on...
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and his NATO counterparts are meeting in Romania to discuss ways to provide Ukraine with more military aid, including air defense systems. Ahead of the meeting, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg accused Russia of using winter as a weapon by targeting Ukraine's energy infrastructure, leaving millions of Ukrainians without heat or electricity. Earlier today, Stoltenberg vowed NATO would continue to support Ukraine.
Therefore, to create the conditions for lasting peace, which ensures that Ukraine prevails as an independent sovereign state, we must continue to provide military support to Ukraine. So our message from Bucharest is that NATO will continue to stand with Ukraine for as long as it takes. We will not back down.
The NATO meeting is taking place as Politico is reporting some European officials are privately accusing the U.S. of profiting from the war in Ukraine. One senior European official recently told Politico, quote, "The fact is, if you look at it soberly, the country that is most profiting from this war is the U.S. because they're selling more gas at higher prices and because they're selling more weapons," unquote. Authorities in China have moved to prevent more large protests against the country's zero COVID policies. In Beijing, police surrounded the site where protesters were planning to gather Monday. Meanwhile, in Shanghai, police erected large barriers where protests were held over the weekend. Police made several arrests at a small protest in the southern city of Hangzhou on Monday night. Meanwhile, Chinese officials have begun lifting some COVID-19 restrictions following this weekend's unprecedented protests. China's also announced a new drive to vaccinate more residents over the age of 80. Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen has resigned as head of the ruling Democratic Progressive Party after her party suffered major losses in local elections Saturday. Voters in Taiwan overwhelmingly backed the opposition Nationalist Party, which has historically supported closer ties with China. In labor news, President Biden sided with big business and has urged Congress to intervene to block freight rail workers from going on strike, saying it could devastate the economy. On Monday, Biden asked lawmakers to quickly pass legislation to impose a labor deal that's been opposed by the majority of freight rail workers. In a statement, Biden said, quote, "As a proud pro-labor president, I'm reluctant to override the ratification procedures and the views of those who voted against the agreement. But in this case, where the economic impact of a shutdown would hurt millions of other working people and families, I believe Congress must use its powers to adopt this deal," Biden said. Many union activists criticized Biden's move to block a strike. Ron Kaminko, a locomotive engineer and organizer for Railroad Workers United, spoke to Democracy Now! Last night.
We could have seen Biden actually opt for telling Congress he would like to see Congress pass legislation that mediates an end to the conflict under which more favorable terms to the workers, which is to say a handful of sick days. And that's what this has come down to. Railroad workers traditionally have had no sick time. And now with the very, very harsh attendance policies that we're faced with, railroad workers get very, very little time off work.
This all comes as profits soar for the freight rail industry, which has reduced the rail workforce by 30% over the last 6 years. In news from Buffalo, New York, the white teenager who shot dead 10 people at a Buffalo supermarket in a predominantly black neighborhood in May has pleaded guilty to murder and hate-motivated terrorism charges. The gunman faces a sentence of life in prison without parole. Buffalo Mayor Byron Brown spoke Monday.
But today, as District Attorney Flynn has said, justice has been done. This individual has admitted their guilt, and the penalty for this horrific crime is for this individual never, ever to see the light of day again. Life imprisonment without the possibility of parole.
A candlelight vigil was held Monday night in Chesapeake, Virginia, to remember the six Walmart workers who were shot dead by a store manager a week ago. The victims in the mass shooting ranged in age from 16 to 70. Authorities say the shooter used a 9-millimeter handgun that he'd bought just hours earlier. Five police officers in New Haven, Connecticut, have been arrested and charged for their role in an incident that left a black man named Randy Cox paralyzed. On June 19th, police arrested the 36-year-old man on a suspicion of illegally possessing a handgun. He was then handcuffed and placed in the back of a police van without a seatbelt. After the van made an abrupt stop, Cox slid into the van's back metal wall, seriously injuring his neck and spine. Officers then ignored his pleas for help. Charges against the five officers include second-degree reckless endangerment. The state of Arizona sued the Republican-controlled county of Cochise after its board of supervisors refused to certify the results of the 2022 election. The lawsuit was filed by Arizona Secretary of State Katie Hobbs, who defeated Republican Trump-endorsed candidate Carrie Lake in the closely watched gubernatorial race. On Monday, Arizona's largest county, Maricopa, certified the election results unanimously after a raucous public meeting where supporters of Lake claimed the election was rigged without offering evidence. Lake is a loyal supporter of Trump's false claims of a rigged 2020 presidential election. She's refused to concede defeat after losing to Katie Hobbs. The New York Times, The Guardian, and three major European newspapers are urging the Biden administration to drop all charges against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. In a joint letter, the newspapers say, quote, this indictment sets a dangerous precedent and threatens to undermine America's First Amendment and the freedom of the press. The letter ends with the words, publishing is not a crime. Julian Assange, who is jailed in Britain, faces up to 175 years in a U.S. prison on espionage and hacking charges for exposing U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan and Iraq. The five publications, which also include Le Monde, Der Spiegel, and El País in Spain, had partnered with WikiLeaks in 2010 to report on documents leaked by Chelsea Manning. The Biden administration's eased some sanctions on Venezuela and has given Chevron approval to resume pumping oil in Venezuela. The announcement came after the government of President Nicolas Maduro resumed talks with Venezuelan opposition groups in Mexico City to address Venezuela's economic and humanitarian crisis. In news from the occupied West Bank, Israeli military forces have demolished a Palestinian primary school south of Hebron. Video posted online shows young Palestinian students in tears as they had to leave their classroom before a bulldozer destroyed their school in Masafer Yatta. The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem condemned the school demolition, saying, quote, this is part of a state effort to drive Palestinians out of the area by making their lives unbearable. Expelling residents is a war crime, B'Tselem said. The European Union also condemned the school demolition. Earlier today, Israeli forces shot dead four Palestinians, including a pair of brothers in the West Bank. At the United Nations, the UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process, Tor Wennesland, warned Monday the situation in the occupied West Bank is reaching a boiling point.
Mr. President, after decades of persistent violence, illegal settlement expansion, dormant negotiation, and deepening occupation, the conflict is again reaching a boiling point.
In news from Northern Ireland, a former British soldier has been convicted of killing a Catholic man in 1988. The soldier, David Holden, shot 23-year-old Aidan McEnesby in the back near a British Army checkpoint. Holden's the first British veteran to be convicted of killing an Irish civilian since the 1998 Good Friday Agreement was signed. The Missouri Supreme Court has refused to halt the execution of Kevin Johnson, despite a special prosecutor's request for a stay in order to fully investigate how the case was tainted by racism. The court's ruling was 5-2. Johnson, who is African American, is scheduled to be executed today. Visit democracynow.org to see our coverage of the case. Donald Trump is facing growing condemnation for hosting white supremacist Nick Fuentes at his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida last week. Fuentes, who is a Holocaust denier, dined with the president along with rapper Kanye West, who was suspended from Twitter last month for making anti-Semitic comments. Trump's former vice president, Mike Pence, said, quote, "President Trump was wrong to give a white nationalist, an anti-Semite, and a Holocaust denier a seat at the table. I think he should apologize for it, and he should denounce those individuals and their hateful rhetoric without qualification," Pence said. At the White House, Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre also condemned Trump's actions.
This administration, this president, totally rejects bigotry, racism, anti-Semitism, and there is just no place for these types of vile forces in our society.
In Texas, over 2 million Houston residents remain under a boil water notice after a power outage at a city water purification plant over the weekend. Many businesses were forced to close and schools will remain closed through Wednesday as Houston officials review water samples to determine whether it's safe to drink or use. Many residents said they didn't hear about the boil water advisory till Monday, though it was issued a day earlier. Houston officials said they expect the notice to be lifted today. A federal judge has issued a cease and desist order forcing retail giant Amazon to stop retaliating against workers involved in union organizing. Amazon executives will also have to publicly read the 30-page ruling to employees at the Staten Island, New York Amazon warehouse Thursday. The warehouse, known as JFK 8, became the first to pass a union vote in April. Amazon has since launched an aggressive intimidation campaign against workers, fending off union elections in Bessemer, Alabama, and at least two other warehouses in New York. The National Labor Relations Board said in a statement, quote, "This relief is critical to ensure that Amazon employees everywhere can fully and freely exercise their rights to join together and improve their working conditions, including by forming, assisting, or joining a union." Meanwhile, in California, employees at two Pete's Coffee stores in Davis have filed paperwork with the NLRB to hold the coffee chain's first ever unionization vote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And you can always get Democracy Now! Here in the Northeast Kansas area. Well, you're on the internet. You go to democracynow.org and listen to it anytime. But here in the morning, if you're that ambitious when you're trying to get ready to go to work, you can listen to it on channel 19.2. I think that is KANU. It's the PBS affiliate out of Kansas City at 7 in the morning. 7 in the morning, you can listen to it on your way out the door. And not just get the headlines like I give you, but get the stories. And there's some damn good stories in there that drill down deep into our system of whatever you want to call it. I was disturbed the other day to find out through the Kansas Reflector, a very fine publication that you should subscribe to and support during this holiday season. It doesn't require much. They don't ask for much. The Kansas Reflector. It's an outstanding Kansas-wide online newspaper. And they pointed out to me, the editorial, that 60,000 people did not, you know, normally we were short 60,000 people. 60,000 registered voters this last November than what we were 2 years ago. 60,000. It would have made a big difference. You know, we need to look. I mean, look, listeners, brothers and sisters, we need to look at the vote like a bullet. It's nonviolent. It's practically secret. It should be more so. But it is the most important thing we can do as registered voters, and we should try to get everybody to be registered voters. Everybody to be registered voters in the state of Kansas and the United States. 60,000 did not vote based on how many voted just 2 years ago in the general election this last November. I mean, it is, well.
Dear young people.
Don't vote.
Don't vote.
Everything's fine the way it is.
Trump, that was us.
He's our guy.
Tax cuts for the rich? Hell yeah, I'm rich as fuck.
Climate change? That's a you problem. I'll be dead soon.
Sure, school shootings are sad.
But I haven't been in a school for 50 years.
I can't keep track of which lives matter.
Sure you don't like it. So, you'll like some meme on Instagram.
If the weather is nice, maybe you could go to one of those little marches.
You might even share this video on Facebook.
But you won't vote.
You young people never do.
But I do. I do.
I do.
Midterms, primaries.
Every single election.
We'll be there, but you won't.
Because we're a generation of doers.
Not whiners.
And we're doing great.
I mean, that is it. I mean, that's it. Look. The propensity for violent revolution is now in the hands of the pro-capitalist people, the right wing. I mean, hell, I'm sort of pro-capitalist. Sort of. I'm sort of pro-capitalist. But, man, I mean, with Kanye West and Donald Trump and I mean, look, don't fool yourself. These people they're in power. They're the base. They're the power. The reactionaries are quite skillfully leading them into what they want, which is a violent civil war. Treat your ballot every year, every time you get a chance to vote, treat your ballot like in order to avoid violence.
Hi, listeners. This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m., we'll talk about prisons since the Fugitive Slave Act to the Attica Uprising to 2018 prison strike. Stay tuned for more information on strikes and rebellions wherever they occur. Only on the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. See you there.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alice Smith.
O heavenly grid, help us bear up thy standard, our chevron flashing bright across the gulf of compromise, standing humble on the rich field of mobile American thinking. Here in this shell, we call life.
Our opening prayer, O Heavenly Grid, was from the Firesign Theater. It is dedicated to the late and deceased COP27 climate conference held in Egypt this month. Meanwhile, Catherine Ganswind from the German Enviro Group Ergewald reports oil, gas, and coal companies have announced the end of the future. They have big expansion plans. From Massachusetts, expert glaciologist Julie Brigham Grett reports ice collapse in the latest Cryosphere 2022 report. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith.
COP27.
The reviews are in.
In the UK, longtime Guardian columnist, author, and activist tweeted, "There was no progress on stopping climate breakdown. COP27 is another terrible failure." Bill McGuire is Professor Emeritus of Geophysical and Climate Hazards from the University of College London. His headline in The Guardian, "The big takeaway from COP27? These climate conferences just aren't working." End quote. It's hard to argue with that, Bill. He's been on Radio EcoShock, by the way, and he writes, "No seasoned observers are of the opinion that the world is any nearer tackling the climate emergency. Indeed, the real legacy of COP27 could well be exposing the climate summit for what it has become, a bloated traveling circus that sets up once a year and from which little but words ever emerge. It really does beggar belief," Bill says, "that in the course of 27 COPs, there has never been a formal agreement to reduce the world's fossil fuel use," end quote from Bill McGuire. One of the world's leading climate scientists says, "Don't panic yet." From Penn State, this inventor of the famous hockey stick graph of climbing temperatures, Michael Mann says, "Don't despair. It's never about a single COP. Yes, this year's summit, like every summit, fell short of what is needed, but the overall trajectory is progress. This is not the time to give up on the world's only functional framework to tackle climate change." That's a quote from Michael Mann. Famous author and lefty activist Naomi Klein says the COP system is not working. Jake Johnson covered Klein's reaction for Common Dreams. "Let's try something new." Naomi Klein calls for boycott of next COP climate summit. He quotes Klein saying, "Now is the time to decide not to do this all over again next year, when the summit will be in the UAE. Yes, the site of next year's climate conference of the parties is in the super oil and gas producing Gulf state, the United Arab Emirates. That sounds like a great place for activism and input from NGOs or even those pesky scientists, except it will be another playground for fossil fuel lobbyists." Why are the world climate summits failing now 27 times? We could circle back to George Monbiot with his key idea, the pollution paradox.
The pollution paradox. The more damaging the commercial enterprise, the more money it must spend on politics to ensure it is not regulated out of existence. As a result, politics comes to be dominated by the most harmful commercial enterprises.
George continues, global negotiations are a charade. The rich world governments meeting in Egypt at the moment have no intention of taking the required action to address the climate crisis, paying the money they've promised poor nations, or doing anything other than what the corporate lobbyists demand. They would rather see the end of the habitable planet than upset their sponsors, says George Monbiot. One of the greatest geniuses of all time, Dr. Albert Einstein, said, "Insanity is doing the same thing over and over, expecting different results." I am with Naomi on this one. The process is not working. In fact, the COP system is built to fail. Every citizen and group and government who actually want climate action have to get organizing and start the real climate summit. In fact, we need far more than a summit once a year on this countdown to climate hell. The world needs to fund and establish an emergency headquarters built on a distributed network from every quarter of civilization. This institution would have scientists, lawyers, economists, politicians, investigators, and activists working full-time every hour to change us away from emissions, to end the fossil fuels, and to get more climate-friendly agriculture. Damaging the climate is a crime, not a plan for profit. Our next guest says climate wrecking is the plan. The most profitable companies in the world have already announced your future forecast. It is a greenhouse world where weather extremes and mass casualties are normal. Yes, oil, gas, and coal multinationals plan to expand until we reach a hellscape way over 2 degrees hotter. They are telling us right out loud. A group of nonprofits are listening and taking notes. A global database led by the German environment group Urgewald began tracking world coal projects, but now we also have Google, the global oil and gas exit list. It tracks 900 companies responsible for 95% of oil and gas production. Our guest, Katrin Ganswit, is an energy finance researcher for Urgewald from Germany. Katrin Ganswit, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Hello.
Hi. Well, everybody loves a hidden conspiracy, but are the intentions of fossil fuel companies a secret?
No, I don't think they're a secret. They're in every annual report of every company you want to have a look at, basically. But what is maybe sometimes hard to see is the big picture. So what we're trying to do is really look at the full fossil fuel industry. As you said, we looked at the coal industry since 2017, and since last year we also compile the global oil and gas exit list. So like this, you have it in one database, all the actual production and actual plans of the oil and gas industry.
So just to be clear, you have a coal project, you have the gas and oil exit list, and then you just recently released a report before COP27. Tell us about that.
Yes, so because the COP is in the African continent and because the interest in fossil fuels from Africa never stopped and is even rising since we have the energy crisis in Europe around the Ukraine-Russia war, we had to look at Africa in general as a whole. And we used our research from our global oil and gas exit list and from our global coal exit list and extended it a bit even, and we had a look at all the companies who are expanding fossil fuel usage or fossil fuel resources on the African continent. We released a report during COP on November the 14th at a press conference there to tell directly to people who were at COP interested in the subject or also the ones who didn't want to hear it about how there's still colonization in Africa through energy exploitation.
Right, so that's the report. Who is financing fossil fuel expansion in Africa? It's available free from Urgewald and other sites. So France's company, the Total Energies, they're planning, investing, and building a lot of new fossil fuels in Africa. And as you say, it sounds a little like energy colonization. Is that what you see happening? And is this, are these new wells and all the projects really going to help Africans who need it the most?
Our report was supported by 36 African NGOs, and the term colonization, actually the term of we are the global north is using Africa as a petrol station, came from them. It was said also by Omar Amavi, who was at our press conference, who's leading the Stop EACOP campaign. And they were clear, our partners also, when we talked to them before we wanted to compile the report, and they state that also in the intro of the report, that fossil fuel resources who are now newly developed in Africa are mainly for the use of the global north. We can see that in different parts. We can see that just less than a third of the companies who are looking for new oil and gas resources in Africa are from African countries. Over 60% of the companies who are now developing new oil and gas resources are from outside of Africa. 90% of the new LNG capacity built in Africa is for export. Over 50% of the pipelines built in Africa are for export to Europe. So it's not there as a This expansion of fossil fuels is not there to support the African continent, but to support the European or Asian countries who want to use the resources. And in Africa itself, many groups are demanding a change to full renewable energy on the African continent. They're stating again and again that this continent contributed the least to climate change, but still has 40% of the renewable potential of the globe. And what we can show also with our data is that there are several LNG terminals, for example, planned on the continent, which cost about $30 billion. And at the same time, the International Energy Agency says $25 billion are necessary per year to make Africa renewable until 2030. So our report shows very clearly money and investments have to go into a totally different direction than they do now.
Going to the global look in the global oil and gas exit list, we find huge expansion plans leading to something called, quote, an IEA NZE overshoot. What is that?
Yes, our IEA net zero overshoot scenario is based on the Net Zero by 2050 report, the roadmap the IEA laid out last year, which should limit global warming to 1.5 degrees. The IEA is a very conservative organization. Nevertheless, banks, financial institutions, industry likes to listen to the IEA, and they really have come a long way that we can, even if their data is very, or their projections are very over-optimistic, we still use it to show, basically to translate what we see in our lists, what that means according to the IEA net zero scenario. So we are looking at how many new oil and gas resources are currently developed and how many of them have been under development before January 2021, because everything which is under development since then is not in line according to the IEA net zero 2050 scenario. So they have, these companies have an overshoot. So we can very clearly, for example, say there are the top six companies with the highest IEA net zero overshoot. Three of them are majors, Exxon, Total, and Chevron, and then there are three national companies, Saudi Aramco, Qatar Energy, and ENOC.
You know, it's interesting. Most of the climate campaigns that I'm familiar with target the Western multinationals like ExxonMobil or Chevron, but it seems like we just don't know enough, and maybe we're a little afraid, to tackle the Middle East countries like Saudi Aramco and Qatar Energy and the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company. I wonder, are these major climate killers, who are planning on expanding the most, by the way, are they getting a pass from environmental activists and from governments?
I wouldn't say so, but obviously, it's very obvious that the more pressure you can do in societies where it's possible to speak at least to a certain average of freeness, yeah, or where media can say what they want. So that's the one point. And the other question is, of course, who does a company get money from? So the more a company is nationalized and also gets national and public funds, the harder it is, of course, to campaign on that on a global scale. We were looking mainly at private financial institutions. So also our campaigning goes more like to the private capital, which is campaignable, so to say. So I wouldn't say there's a free pass, but on the one hand, it's a question of opportunity. And then there's, of course, the question of, like, just because there are other companies we maybe cannot tackle, which are maybe as bad as the ones in our own countries or in our whole region, it doesn't mean we don't still have the historical duty to campaign against those which are in front of our nose, so to say.
Well, Katrin, you live in Germany, a European country scrambling to find more fossil fuels after the failure of Russian supplies. Consumers all over the world demand their gas tanks be filled, their homes be heated, all the consumer goodies have to keep coming. Can we blame Middle Eastern monarchs for giving us what we want?
Not as long as we pay for it. I mean, here in the German radio news, you hear more about how people are angry about soccer games in Qatar than they were about our chancellor and our head energy company in Germany going to Qatar asking for gas. So this doesn't add up. So in the end, it's the question, if we want to see leadership on how to do renewable energy transition and go away from fossil fuels, we have to do that in front of our doorstep first before we demand that only from others. It has to be both ways always.
So Google, as we'll call it, reports 96% of upstream companies have expansion plans. What is an upstream business, and what does that say about the energy transition?
Upstream means basically the production of oil and gas. So production with conventional but also unconventional methods like fracking, tar sands, ultra-deep water drilling. And it says basically that the oil and gas producers don't have any plans to change their business model and that none of them have a credible transition plan. If these companies would really want to transition, they should first stop to expand their operations. The old business model is you show how many reserves you develop, and according to that, you are rated. According to that, your share price is connected. So they didn't change any of that. They didn't understand yet either they didn't yet understand climate change or they don't care about it. And I mean, we have seen that there were reports on growing numbers of fossil fuel lobbyists at each COP, basically, and we still don't see fossil fuels in the COP text as demanded, and it's phased down or phased out.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. Ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Katrin Ganswit, an energy researcher for the environment group Ergovald. Your specialty is coal. Our recent guest, Patrick Bond, told us Germany is searching for more coal, including a visit this year by German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, trying to find more coal. We thought Germany was getting out of that dirty power source. What's going on?
We're going out of the dirty power source, but first of all, the nitty-gritty details of the plan can change. But the other part of this, of course, as long as coal plants are still running, you still need new coal to fuel it. The big problem of the fossil fuel resources are they're not abundant like wind and energy, but you still have to dig them up. And that's basically what is still happening in Germany. And there is a big discussion, of course, on how much coal is actually really needed and if all the coal which is digged out shouldn't be left in the ground because we should stop using coal much earlier than 2030. But this is why we're still looking for new coal, because we still burn it.
Makes sense. Okay, so now Patrick Bond also spoke of gaping holes and illusions in the project to transition the South African coal mining industry into renewables. What have you heard about how that project is going?
Yeah, the South African coal industry, it's also twofold. You have, on the one hand, of course, the country being dependent about 80% on coal energy, and about a third of the coal which is produced in South Africa is also exported to Asia, but of course also to Europe, and even more so now since we don't have or don't want to use Russian supplies anymore in Germany. And what we see there, what we hear from our partners in South Africa, is that a big problem is, of course, the Eskom, the national utility Eskom. They have a really bad track record on maintenance, on their huge new coal projects, and still there's regular load shedding for several hours for South African people. There's a lot of loss in transport of energy. It's a lot of energy is used for the industry, and actually the real energy transition cannot happen in South Africa as long as a clear phase-out for coal isn't announced, and as long as also the energy ministry is still pursuing for the use of other fossil fuels as a transition, like gas, a so-called transition.
Before the COP, Ergovald, along with Stand.Earth and 40 partner NGOs, released the 2022 update for the Global Coal Exit List. First, please explain what an exit list is, and then how it can be used by researchers or campaigners.
Our global coal exit list should show the full coal industry. It was made because we saw that financial institutions are not aware of what a coal company is, even if they claim to want to divest from coal. On the other hand, it was also possible with such a list to check portfolios, for example, of your pension fund, or to do research on the real investments and financing of banks, and like that to support not only our own campaign, but also NGO campaigns. So we use the list on the one hand, we distribute it to financial institutions to make good, impactful coal policies, and now with the goggle also oil and gas policies, and for our NGO colleagues to do impactful campaigns.
There has been a myth, even in environmental circles, that coal is winding down. It is a dirty sunset industry from a past century. It's headed for bankruptcy and shutdowns. And when you dig into 1,000 coal companies and their subsidiaries and their plans, is that what you find happening?
Either what we see is that the expansion of the industry is slowing down, especially the power plant expansion, because as said, as long as you burn coal, you need mines, continuous coal supply. But we definitely see a winding down of the expansion in specific countries, and we see a beginning or already implemented coal phase-out in different European countries. We also see a winding down of coal in the U.S. We, of course, see on the other side the rise of LNG, of fracking in the U.S. Yeah, so you always have to look at that as a whole, yeah, on the whole fossil fuel industry, especially if you look at coal. You always have to ask, if a company wants to phase out coal, is it replaced with gas or a country? This is also a question we actually had very early since we produced and distribute the global coal exit list, discussions with NGOs, but also with financial institutions are always, okay, what's next? What's coming after coal, basically, as the subject of gas and not just winding down coal, but actually not replacing it with gas, is it there? And obviously you have differences when you look at the whole globe. As we know, there's still a lot of expansion plans, for example, in China, and in general, the most energy growth, of course, is in Asia.
Indonesia is right now building a huge coal plant as we speak, and of course they're a major miner and exporter of coal, so they haven't stopped. At the recent Egyptian COP, India called for a different language about coal. They continued to argue India should be allotted enough energy to develop, as Western countries did. But then they add this wrinkle. Why should developed countries discriminate against coal? I mean, Europe and America want to keep their gas. They call this methane fuel natural. Some even want to label it green. But India has to give up its staple energy source, which happens to be coal, they say. What do you think?
Yeah, in a way, of course, he's right. I mean, this is also the question who you point that comment towards. Because, of course, if you look at the country on the government level, that's exactly the point. As long as developed nations who have a historical duty to reduce CO2 emissions faster, as long as they're still labeling gas green, I don't wonder people in China and India say, as long as Germany still burns coal, as long as everyone's still labeling gas green, we're going to keep our coal, or we make clean coal plants. Yeah, of course, that is the answer. I don't wonder, maybe if I can, one note on Indonesia, because you're right, and the big specialty is on Indonesia, of course, that it's a big exporter, so its economy is depending on the export and not only the energy system, also to a much larger extent than, for example, South Africa.
Well, none of this dangerous coal development happens without big money behind it. You report Royal Bank of Canada, Citibank, and major public pensions continue to bankroll coal. Is there a growing list of large-scale institutions who have sworn off coal investing?
Yeah, there is. The question is rather like, it's not in all financial centers of the world, unfortunately. So we see, especially on coal, a big development in Europe. We see rather smaller steps in the U.S. still, especially when it comes on company exclusion level, and also only at first financial institutions in different Asian places like Malaysia or Singapore or the Philippines, where you see actually movement. So the biggest movement is still in Europe, and we do not see, for example, that especially when it comes to oil and gas, there is like the big front runners already. But in the coal area, we definitely can see that.
But the top four coal plant developers are all Chinese companies. Talk to us about coal in China.
In China, the coal industry is still growing. That is to say about China, it's hard to do or to change what's happening inside China from outside. What was successful was campaigns or whatever internal lobbying in China also happened on new coal plants or new coal projects outside of China. So we could see several projects which have been stopped or delayed, where, for example, the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China stepped out in Africa, for example, in Kenya or in Zambia. So we saw a success there. Inside China, and of course also the financing of Chinese coal companies can happen almost exclusively through China. Nevertheless, we do see especially investments also in Chinese coal companies that have special financial subsidiaries. Through them, they can also derive money on other stock markets. So there is still financial flows to Chinese coal from the global north.
And when a coal power plant is built, the expectation is it will operate for about 60 years. All the new coal plants built in the next few years would be spewing carbon and pollution until 2080. At the same time, we've already crossed these irreversible climate tipping points. What really needs to happen in the coal industry?
It has to stop operating as soon as possible. I would say in Europe now, but we said that 5 years ago. We said that 10 years ago, I think, already. And I think the more we see that it's hard, or that there is resistance in the global south to change their track, or in countries like India and China, however you want to classify them, on that track, it actually means in the global north we have to try harder. As said, we have this global responsibility of, or this historical responsibility of being historical, the biggest emitters, and that's why we also have to be the front runners by far on phasing out all fossil fuels, and at the beginning, or at the worst, obviously coal. And then we can, at the same time, demand the same from other nations.
Can civilization really survive without coal? Wouldn't a lot of people die without it?
Interesting question. I think I haven't been asked that so far. So far, I've been asked only by, let's say, conservative financial institutions if it wouldn't be bad for development and people would lose their jobs. In fact, it's no secret that coal mining as well as coal combustion has severe health risks for the local population. Because you talked about Africa before, I know from my own experience that in the mining regions in South Africa, the local population, the kids who grow up there, usually their lungs are so bad they can't even work in the mines. So coal kills, as the campaign Life After Coal in South Africa says, and obviously not using coal would be much better for the local health. And as well, it's no secret that the use of renewable energies and the maintenance in the renewable sector can also create a lot of jobs. The question is just how early does this country start to transition? Does a country start to transition early enough so they're not trapped in the fossil fuel trap forever?
So we've got men, mostly men, in suits proposing great big projects in corporate boardrooms around the world. And your group and your fellow colleagues help to figure out what the total is. But do we think that national leaders in Riyadh and Paris and Washington and Beijing have added it up? Do they know what is being developed here, and yet they still issue all the permits and the subsidies and the guarantees to make it happen?
Of course, I can just guess what they really know and think. The biggest cheer of humanity is very clear about climate change, and also very clear about where it comes from. But there's lots of ways to try to steer towards wrong solutions, or of putting all money into solutions which are not the obvious and clear one. And I think people know that, and either they believe they can just still make a dime just before this world goes down, or maybe gone to Mars before it's getting bad, or they overestimate the little time we have to make a change.
I'm afraid all of that is true. So, Catherine, when you go home at night with all these figures in your head, do you think there is a way out of this mess?
Honestly, I don't know. I hope so. And I also have a little kid, and I wouldn't want to tell her I didn't try.
Absolutely. And I say the same to my own grandson. Could you please tell our listeners where they can find this useful information about the fossil fuel industry and their expansion plans?
So all our data is explained, accessible, researchable online. We have on coalexit.org the global coal exit list. You can also see our financial research on the whole global coal industry and look for a bank of your choice or investor of your choice. And we also have on Google.org, so don't confuse it with Google, it's just the acronym of Global Oil and Gas Exit List. And also here you can find, first of all, also lots of background stories and different projects, connections to other NGOs who are working on this reputational risk projects on the ground, and you can download the Excel file. In both cases, we ask for free login to just count how many people are using it. Does it make sense? Is it interesting? Does it make sense to do it again? So please log in and download our list and have a look, and you find contact there where you can ask us all kinds of questions on that.
I will put links to the Global Oil and Gas Exit List and coalexit.org and a lot more in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Catherine, thank you for speaking with our listeners.
Thanks for the interview.
We've been speaking with respected German environment group Urgewald and the leading energy researcher there, Catherine Ganswit.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
In November, Hurricane Nicole swept away foundations along the Florida coast. The nightly news flashed images of homes and apartment buildings fallen into the sea or tottering dangerously at the edge. This is a glimpse into the future as ice disappears from the poles. To get a global picture of the changing ice world, a network of scientists formed the International Cryosphere Initiative. Their State of the Cryosphere 2022 report finds sea ice and glaciers from the poles to the Himalayas are endangered species. We reached Julia Brigham Grett, a scientist at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and co-author of the new report. Julie is an authority on glacial geology and their history and past climates. From Massachusetts, Julie Brigham Grett, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much.
From research vessels to camps on the ice, you have seen what we have not. What is it like to be a human in the presence of vast ice more than a mile deep?
It's an awesome experience because of the power that you feel when the ice calves from the front in a tidewater glacier, when that ice falls off and that booming sound happens. It's just an awesome feeling of the power of that ice. And also, as a geologist, seeing the erosion and the capacity of these ice sheets to change our planet, that's an awesome feeling that I get when I'm near a glacier.
Well, just to be clear, what is the cryosphere? Is it just ice at the poles?
No, actually, the cryosphere is a term that refers to everything that's frozen in the sense of, we think of glaciers and ice sheets first, but it also includes the sea ice in the polar regions, the seasonal changes in sea ice. It also includes the permafrost, the frozen ground that's year after year stays below freezing across large swaths of the Arctic. And we also include in the cryosphere the mountain glaciers, the small ice sheets and small glaciers in like the Andes and the Himalayas and even in the Cascades of the Pacific Northwest. These are essentially water towers for the planet that feed water supplies to the people who live in those regions. So the cryosphere includes all of those things. And the other thing that we've also included in our report is the effect of ocean acidification in the polar regions, and that is the changing pH in the ocean caused by CO2 in the atmosphere.
What has that got to do with the ice, though?
Well, so as the CO2 in the atmosphere is currently increasing 10 times than anything we've seen in 50 million years, literally, we're seeing this rapid rise in CO2 caused by humans, and that CO2 gets absorbed into the surface ocean. And so it lowers the pH and it makes it much more difficult for calcium organisms to calcify their shells. So the base of the food chain in a lot of the surface oceans of the polar regions are based on these small organisms, and many of them are having trouble making their shells and surviving, and it takes a long time for that to recover. So we include that as part of our concerns about the polar regions. You know, anyone that's opened a bottle of champagne or even a soda of some sort knows that carbon dioxide will stay more dissolved in cold water than it does in warm water. So just try opening a warm bottle of champagne sometime and you'll know what I mean. So in the polar regions, that cold water has the capacity to take up even more CO2. And so we're seeing an increase in calcium carbonate. So it doesn't really have much to do with glaciers, and it's not exactly my field of study, but it is a concern because it goes in parallel with what's happening to the glaciers and ice sheets, to the cryosphere, with our increasing fossil fuel use.
I began talking about wrecked coastlines. Do you think melting ice at both poles is already contributing to wrecked coastlines?
Absolutely. It's a crisis that's being felt in many parts of the world. I've been working with indigenous people living along the southwest coast of Alaska, Some people refer to this area as the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. It's a large, flat landscape that is sinking naturally because it's a delta, so it's receiving weight from the Yukon River, from the sediments. But also sea level is rising there, and there's tremendous coastal erosion there because it's permafrost, frozen ground at the coast. It's also being thermally eroded. So this is, in many ways, ground zero for Alaska. Oddly enough, a state that, of course, extracts a lot of fossil fuels. But sea level is rising all over. For example, forecasts are for the Texas, Louisiana, Alabama, Florida coastline, there could be as many as 6 to 10 million people that need to move in the coming decades. And this is schools, factories, cities, and no one's talking about this enough. So in our own country and across the world, sea level is rising, and unfortunately, it's not reversible. You know, sea level rise is essentially forever on human timescales.
You talked about the thrill, if I could say it that way, of seeing these glaciers calve away, and I know that 10 or 15 years ago, reading reports from glaciologists, it seemed like that was the main concern of how water was going to reach the oceans. But now a recent study from Antarctica discovers a deep river running from lakes below the glaciers to the Southern Ocean. Is it possible there's a massive underground of meltwater in both Antarctica and Greenland that we don't know a lot about yet? And if so, what would that mean for sea level rise?
Well, exactly. One thing we have learned from both Greenland and parts of Antarctica are there are subglacial lakes in many places that we didn't realize. And now that we know that they're there, scientists are discovering even more of them as the geophysics improves. And we're now capable to actually see these lakes communicate to one another. So you can actually, there are scientists who can actually see the surface of the ice sheet slightly go up and down as these water bodies underneath drain from one lake to another. And the problem with that much water at the base of the glaciers, at the base of the ice sheets, is that, of course, they're not in contact with the bed, so they're not, there's a loss of friction. Just like hydroplaning with your car on a wet, rainy day, you lose contact and lose friction, and this will cause the glaciers to slide even faster. And we have to go back to when Canada and North America were covered with large ice sheets. We find evidence that this happened in these earlier glaciations as well. We can learn by looking at past ice sheets about what we might think about the behavior of the ice sheets we have left on the planet. So it is a serious concern, and we now know there's a lot more water at the bottom of these glaciers than we thought before.
Well, let's look at the new report. The State of the Cryosphere report summarizes the main threats with four different futures, depending on our emissions, of course. And the first is very low to low emissions, and it sounds like something we could have hoped for 20 years ago. But for me, that's in the rearview mirror. Not everyone agrees with that. What do you think? Should we really be counting on these low to very low emission scenarios?
Well, we have to remain hopeful to slow down the warming of the planet. And I have to say I agree with you. I think overshoot, going beyond 1.5 degrees, we're already at 1.2 degrees above pre-industrial for the planet. So dropping our emissions to keep the planet below 1.5 does seem like a long shot, a real long shot. But the truth is, the other scenarios, particularly if we go over 2 to 3 degrees, there's some really critical tipping points with the glaciers and ice sheets that could be surpassed, particularly if we go beyond 2 and to 3 degrees. And let me give you an example. I've studied across the Arctic a time period about 3 million years ago, which really isn't that long ago, but 3 million years ago when there was no Greenland ice sheet, there was no sea ice in the Arctic, and we had forested conditions all across Arctic Canada. In fact, even Hudson's Bay hadn't formed yet. And at that time, the temperature of the planet was about 3 degrees above pre-industrial. Only 3 degrees. And we think that the CO2 in the atmosphere at that time was around 400 ppm. So we are already driving the planet toward an environment of what the Earth looked like 3 million years ago with no Greenland ice sheet and probably no West Antarctic ice sheet. And as far as scientists around the world, from the Mediterranean to Australia, New Zealand, and even Alaska, sea level, we think, was around 16 to 23 meters above present at that time. So we're driving the planet, even at 3 degrees, we're driving the planet toward massive sea level rise over the coming centuries. So, you know, the predictions right now are at least probably 1 meter by the time today's first graders are in their 80s. You know, so a meter of sea level rise, if you just look at a place like Florida, is pretty devastating. You know, I think overshoot is likely. We're going to have to get involved with pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere and, you know, all hands on deck approach to decreasing CO2.
Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is expert glaciologist Professor Julie Brigham Grett from the University of Massachusetts, and we're talking about the new 2022 report on world ice. Let's talk about sea ice. In 2007, even scientists were shocked when the Arctic sea ice shrank way back. 2012 was even worse. What is the current state of Arctic sea ice?
Not a happy one, for sure. What scientists who model the Arctic sea ice are seeing, of course, a dramatic shift toward a more open, ice-free Arctic. And we've lost nearly most of the multi-year ice, the ice that's quite several meters thick that persists year after year. There's very little multi-year ice left in the Arctic. And I speak from experience in that when I was first doing fieldwork in 1980 in Arctic Alaska, I got stuck in the sea ice, even in August. But now there's largely open water across the coast of Alaska and certainly parts of Arctic Canada in places where it used to be frozen all the time. And unfortunately and symbolically, about a week ago or a while ago here at the COP in Egypt, a symbolically tipped over a large, what we call a Toblerone, it was like a pillar that had Arctic sea ice written on the side of it, and they toppled it over because we have crossed a tipping point with Arctic sea ice. Even if we drop all the CO2 in the atmosphere and the methane in the atmosphere tomorrow, it's very likely we're still going to see an ice-free Arctic in the coming decades. And in literally 10 to 20, 30 years, the Arctic will be ice-free. So we've kind of missed that tipping point. We're beyond that now, and this is what we worry is we cannot miss other tipping points. So we can slow it down, and Arctic sea ice is something we can bring back if we can cool the planet and lower CO2. So in contrast to sea level, Arctic sea ice is something we could bring back eventually, in the summer sea ice I'm talking about.
Well, scientists on the show have warned an Arctic without sea ice in the summer, the so-called Blue Ocean event, would make changes all over the world. And I noticed that in your report, you even mentioned that sea ice levels can affect faraway lands like Tibet. How is that possible?
Well, an open Arctic Ocean really starts to change. It's absorbing more heat, and of course, it has downstream effects that it can affect the polar front, the way the westerlies are traveling, the waviness of the polar front, and therefore have downstream effects throughout the climate system. And I think that the adage that, you know, what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic is really true, is that the Arctic system and is linked to the global atmospheric system, just like our oceans are. And so we have to expect that there will be effects in other places. I think most people are familiar with the fact that when we have an El Nino event in the South Pacific, it's a warming of the surface oceans. And even though it's so far away in the South Pacific, it has impacts all over the world, causing droughts in Africa, for example. So I think we really need to hopefully raise awareness that the Earth is a complete complex system. So what happens in one place can affect other places, downflow, down ice, and downwind.
Is there other new science that you would like to tell us about in our understanding of ice and climate change at the poles?
I think what's surprising everyone, and you've already hinted about this, is the rate at which things are happening. And I think one of the maybe more frightening revelations that's really emerging now is the amount of CO2 and methane coming from permafrost, from frozen ground as it starts to thaw across large parts of the Arctic. And here again, that flux of even more CO2 and methane into the atmosphere, it means that countries around the world have to even increase their ambition to decrease CO2 to compensate for what now looks like a natural emission due to the warming of the high latitudes. So one thing that's been happening is we're talking about the whole region of permafrost as a country in and of itself. It's already has more emissions coming from permafrost than from the country of Japan, industrialized country of Japan. So the country of permafrost is really a new revelation that we're really trying to grapple with, because again, it's going to take all, we have to cool the planet as fast as we can in order to slow down the emissions from the permafrost. I would say that would be my number one pick for large surprises.
In the English language expression, anything glacial means something moving so slow that we don't really see it. And at the 2012 AAAS conference, the presentations by glaciologists were sparsely attended. I was the only reporter in the room. Now the alarming state of the ice is reaching the front page. When you began your career, did you ever think you would see so much change in your lifetime?
Not at all. In fact, when I was in graduate school, so let's go back 40 years, I was taught that the Greenland ice sheet and Antarctica were stable, and they have been stable for 5,000 years, and that we weren't worried about that. So we were going about our research, studying the past history without so much concern about the future. And here we are so many years later, and we're in the face of really rapid change. In fact, let me mention that we're now going into Antarctic summer, okay, in the southern hemisphere. Over this past few months, there hasn't been much sea ice around McMurdo Station in Antarctica. Now, that's just shocking, because 25 years ago, I was on a National Academy study about how we need to build more icebreakers to get fuel into McMurdo Station in Antarctica. Now there's no sea ice. And so that, in just 25 years, to see an area around Antarctica go from heavy, thick sea ice to not having much at all is just shocking. And I also, as I mentioned earlier, reminisce back to the times when I was working along the Arctic coast and constantly had to deal with sea ice. I could go there today and not have any problems with sea ice at all, because it's retreated so far back to the north in the summer. So this is happening fast within even my own career. So I can't be more shocked than anyone, because I've seen it myself. And if you just speak to the indigenous people living in the Arctic, they will also share their story about this change.
Well, I'm thinking about how we're going to get this word out. And last year, Argentina's parliament passed the National Law of Comprehensive Environmental Education. So the environment will be taught to students of all ages there. Can we teach kids how the cryosphere works, and should we?
Absolutely. We need to teach them about the cryosphere, about the rate at which things are happening, and also provide hope and have them see a future in their contributions to decreasing CO2, to changing the way that we develop our energy. And also to help, I mean, we're going to need psychologists, we're going to need lawyers, we're going to need all kinds of people, not just scientists, to help the particularly coastal environments adapt. We're going to need new ways to grow food. Think about, instead of a couple of days above 100 degrees Fahrenheit in the central part of the United States, we're going to have 3 months of over 100 degrees. Canada might end up growing a lot more food. I mean, we have all kinds of reasons to bring everyone to the table to work on a more sustainable future, and to be optimistic that, yes, we have the tools to change, and people can be optimistic about contributing to that. So we need to keep our young people enthusiastic about their role in helping us reverse the damage that we've caused to the planet, and for them to see a future in that that's helpful and can help change the world. Because being pessimistic is just not going to be very, very hopeful. It's not being optimistic is going to be a bummer, and it just is not going to move us forward. So I believe in optimism and looking at ways for people all to contribute to making the world a better place.
I'm not sure I agree. I don't feel optimistic myself that we can avoid a catastrophic loss of this planetary cooling system. It seems like it's on its way out. It may take hundreds of years or a couple thousand years to really go, but it's just hard for me to build optimism about that. Where I have my optimism is that humans will somehow adapt, and so will the other animals and plants, and we will find a new but different world.
That's very possible, and I certainly would not disagree, but I do think that we all have a place where we can think about a more sustainable and resilient world to the changes that we face. And with that, there has to be hope and optimism.
As we wrap this up, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
Other than I think it's really important for everyone to be aware, think about the global system, not just your own backyard, but think about what's happening to the planet as a whole and to people across the world. And I think we need to really increase our empathy for all of humanity and for all of living systems. And I really wish that global, act locally, think globally type of idea would really resonate around the world.
From the University of Massachusetts Amherst, we've been speaking with Professor Julie Brigham Grett. Julie is co-author of The State of the Cryosphere Report, 2022, Growing Losses, Global Impacts. That report is a free download from ICCINet.org. I will put a link to that in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Julie, thank you for your work and for talking with us today.
All right. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I'd like to talk about a couple of new science questions from the Julie Brigham Grett interview. Julie tells us only 3 million years ago there was no Greenland ice and no sea ice. Forests grew right up to the shores of the Arctic Ocean. How hot was it? Just 3 degrees C hotter than Earth was a few hundred years ago in pre-industrial times. The United Nations reports we are on course for 2.9 degrees C by the end of this century, unless we slash emissions drastically. It gets hotter after that. But many scientists think that is too optimistic. On our current emissions track, setting a new record again last year, Earth might reach 3 degrees of warming before 2100. Greenland will not suddenly emerge bare in the next 80 years. Experts think that process, unstoppable once it starts, would take a few centuries at least, because it's over a mile deep ice that has to melt away. But the Arctic sea ice could be gone now and then, during this decade, and possibly forever in following decades. That changes how much solar energy is reflected back into space. It creates hotter oceans, more heating, and changes in ocean currents and weather as far away as Tibet. How could it do that? The exact mechanisms connecting the Arctic sea ice and Tibet are still a field of developing science. It is a case of teleconnection. Analysis, satellite and ground-based, clearly shows a relationship between specific sea ice patterns in the Arctic and the weather in Tibet. Here is a good paper on what we know. Effects of Arctic sea ice in autumn on extreme cold events over the Tibetan Plateau in the following winter. Possible mechanisms. That is an open access article. It's free to you and it's published October 2021. Find links in my show blog. We also learn from Julie that the Arctic is a living biosphere. She mentions the Arctic is full of living things, and this is partly new science. As Damian Carrington wrote in The Guardian, November 17th, the scientists collected surface meltwaters from 8 glaciers across Europe and North America and from 2 sites on the Greenland ice cap. they found tens of thousands of microbes in each milliliter of water. That's astounding. There's a lot of life going on up there, and we haven't really counted that in when we do our climate science. But here's the sort of new question that I think came up during this interview. Will a hotter Arctic Ocean capture less carbon and thus lead to more heating for all of us? Julie Brigham Grett uses the analogy of a warm champagne bottle or soda. It doesn't hold much bubbly when it's too hot, and that's carbon dioxide, that bubbly. Colder liquids hold more CO2. Surely that implies, even if the Arctic Ocean warms just a little, due to the vast area, that could mean many tons less carbon dioxide sucked into the sea compared to pre-industrial times. Every time a sink like the ocean can hold less, more of the greenhouse gas pollution from our tailpipes and smokestacks stays in the atmosphere, and that means more warming. Scientists have definitely shown the Arctic Ocean is getting more acidic, and that's in the Cryosphere 2022 report. But as far as we know, there has not yet been a study into the impact of polar ocean warming and carbon dioxide capture. It would be interesting to quantify this and then try some projections for low, medium, and high emission scenarios. I think we could be missing yet another factor that will heat the world. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world. Well, we started this show with a prayer. Maybe we should go out with one. This is Reverend Billy from the Church of Stop Shopping, and you should look that up on the internet, the Church of Stop Shopping. Let's get a little bit of Billy's prayer as he starts up his own radio show.
This is Earth Riot Radio. I'm Reverend Billy here at the Church of Stop Shopping in New York. Every minute, every hour, getting news from Egypt, from the COP27 climate conference, and the news, I guess it shouldn't be news to us. But now let's not get too dispirited. Let's say that right up front. You all know what the news is. The investor class won't share the profits that they made at the expense of people who are now asking for help with the losses and the damage, with the death and the mayhem that is visited upon their homes, their loved ones. We won't help them out. We might give them some loans through the IMF and so forth that just deepens their climate debt trap. We might help in certain ways that doesn't hurt us too much, but we won't trim our trillions, will we? We're still in a colonial situation. Well, you and I, as Earth Defenders, what have we got? We have ways that we have been expressing. We have ways that we have been creating our activism. Our direct action sometimes puts us in jail briefly. Not so much the 8 years that Jessica Resnicek in Iowa, taking an acetylene torch to that pipeline. Not many of us have gone that far. Maybe we all have to now. Whatever we do, it will be different. Times are changing now. Let's have a half an hour dedicated to that change. Let's not be afraid. Let's do it. Let's do it together. Will somebody give me an earth hallelujah?
But we really don't have. We don't have a Nelson Mandela for the weather. We have a crisis of leadership in the world that is utterly baffling. As the physical systems give all the evidence they can to us that they're in a state of general degradation. Nobody from any nation state has really stepped up to talk about it. Not really.
Radio EcoShock.
There you have it. And now, you know, Alex Smith broadcasts from a place called Border in British Columbia, Canada. So let's pay tribute to one of Canada's famous musicians, Stan Rogers. And then we'll go to Maria Gilardin's TUC Radio.
For just one time, I would take the Northwest Passage to find the hand of Franklin reaching for the Beaufort Sea. Tracing one warm line through a land so wide and savage, and make a Northwest Passage to the sea. Westward from the Davis Strait is there, 'twas said to lie, the sea route to the Orient for which so many died, seeking gold and glory, leaving weathered broken bones, and a long forgotten lonely cairn of stones. For just one time, I would take the Northwest Passage to find the hand of Franklin reaching for the Beaufort Sea. Tracing one warm line through a land so wide and savage, and make a Northwest Passage to the sea. 3 centuries thereafter, I take passage over land in the footsteps of brave Kelso, where his sea of flowers began. Watching cities rise before me, then behind me sink again. This tardiest explorer driving hard across the plain. For just one time, I would take the Northwest Passage to find the hand of Franklin reaching for the Beaufort Sea. Tracing one warm line through a land so wide and savage, and make a Northwest Passage to the sea. And through the night behind the wheel, the mileage clicking west, I think upon Mackenzie, David Thompson, and the rest, who cracked the mountain ramparts and did show a path for me to race the roaring Fraser to the sea. For just one time, I would take the Northwest Passage to find the hand of Franklin reaching for the Beaufort Sea. Tracing one warm line through a land so wide and savage, and make a Northwest Passage to the sea. How then am I so different from the first men through this way? Like them, I left a settled life, I threw it all away, to seek a Northwest Passage at the call of many men, to find there but the road back home again. For just one time, I would take the Northwest Passage to find the hand of Franklin reaching for the Beaufort Sea. Tracing one warm line through a land so wide and savage, and make a Northwest Passage to the sea.
Stan Rogers, Canadian, with Alex Smith, now TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. TUC Radio Archives, The Quest for Water and the American West, by Dr. Gray Brecken, Imperial San Francisco. This is part two of the history of San Francisco, the town that grew from 16 houses on sand dunes in 1850 to the largest city on the West Coast in only 30 years. Gray Brecken explains in the first chapter of his book, Imperial San Francisco, how the gold rush connected two important factors for city building, a swelling of the population and the growth of investment capital. But the mix of people and money was lacking another major ingredient, water. As the first wave of destruction of California was brought about by gold mining, the second was caused by the damming of rivers and the flooding of land for reservoirs, even eventually inside the protected space of Yosemite National Park. Brecken also explains the connection between the building of Los Angeles and the draining of farmland in the Owens Valley. He ends with an intriguing sketch of the creation of the Bureau of Reclamation. They made the quest for water a national issue. The Bureau claimed to supply water to small farmers, but ended up becoming the greatest builder of cities. And as this program from the TUC Radio Archives is rebroadcast in early December 2022, an extraordinary news item from November 17 headlines that, quote, "The largest dam demolition in history is approved for Western River." 2 weeks ago, U.S. regulators approved a plan to demolish four dams on the Klamath River and open up hundreds of miles of salmon habitat. That would be the largest dam removal and river restoration project in the world when it goes forward, end quote. Here's Gray Brecken and the story of water as he takes you back to the impact of the gold rush.
Tens of thousands of people suddenly arriving on some sand dunes, you know, they're not going to live there very long unless they can get water. And also, it's not only just water for them, it's water for industries and also water for firefighting, because the entire city was made out of wood and canvas. It was a really sort of flimsy, jerry-built, sort of looked like a super mining town. And there's 6 months of drought in California with wind constantly blowing in from the ocean. The city burned down six times in the first 3 years of its existence, and that's not very good if you're a businessman, so you need water for fighting fires as well, too. Private water companies were founded in the 1850s, just after the gold rush, to first exploit the springs and the few small streams that were on the San Francisco Peninsula, and to create flumes to bring that water into San Francisco. That almost immediately proved to be inadequate. There's a little creek, actually, that still provides 2 million gallons a day to the Presidio, and that was the original water supply for San Francisco. But immediately that, you know, the population outstrips that supply, and so then a water company is formed to get water from San Mateo County, south of San Francisco, which has higher mountains and wetter mountains, and that began to be brought in during the Civil War by means of a long flume from San Mateo County. But that meant that all those creeks, which had formerly been salmon runs, I had to be dammed to create reservoirs, killing the salmon, of course, and bringing that water into San Francisco and depriving the farmers of that water as well, too. So it had dramatic environmental consequences for the sacrifice zones, but it enabled San Francisco to continue growing. And the thing about water is the more you have, the more you need, because it just attracts more people, and therefore it's, again, like the maelstrom. You have to have more and more of it. It keeps expanding. You also have to remember that water is not provided for people, it's provided for real estate. It's provided for raising the value of the land. These early water companies rammed a bill through the California state legislature, which enabled them to use eminent domain to acquire these watershed properties, not only for the purity of the water, but for rights of way. But the eminent domain then enabled them to grab whatever they wanted as far as watershed lands, often much in excess of what they actually needed for future speculation, because the water would obviously make that land valuable, and that could later on be sold off as well, too. By 1875, it was clear that even San Mateo County wasn't going to provide enough water, so then the water company crossed the bay, acquired a small river over in Alameda and Santa Clara counties, dammed that, began bringing that in an underwater conduit across the bay, and finally, by the turn of the century, even that wasn't enough because San Francisco was growing so fast, so the city at that time then looked to the Sierra and through some very devious means acquired the Tuolumne River, which comes out of Yosemite National Park, dammed that, the Hetch Hetchy Valley, and brought that into San Francisco. I should say, and it wasn't just into San Francisco, actually. The Hetch Hetchy system provides water for 2.5 million people. It created what they had hoped to create, which was Greater San Francisco, a city which sweeps around San Francisco Bay all the way into what is now Silicon Valley and up through Alameda County. And that is, of course, where these magnates who owned the water company also owned land.
Yeah, there's a map mapping the course of the Hetch Hetchy Aqueduct into San Francisco. And what is curious about it is that unlike the East Bay water system, it has to cross the coastal mountain range, which provided a huge engineering problem because either you have to pump or do a tunnel. And it seems to almost imply that this strange, difficult, expensive course was made in order to pass by the real estate that was to benefit from it.
There have been many studies of all the available water supplies for San Francisco in the 19th century. Lake Tahoe was one of them. They were considering turning Lake Tahoe into a gigantic regulated reservoir to bring water into San Francisco. They were just going to drill a long tunnel using Chinese labor, of course, drill a tunnel through an intervening ridge and then just drain the lake and bring it into San Francisco via, I think it was a 180-mile aqueduct, which would be the longest aqueduct in the world, and bring it into San Francisco. That would have all been gravity feed. San Francisco ultimately chose one of the most difficult ways to get water from the Tuolumne River because it had to go through the Coast Range, which is very broad there. And as you said, it would have required pumping, which requires a vast amount of energy, or the world's longest tunnel, which they eventually built at great expense and great cost of life, in fact. And they brought it in that way, and that brought it into the South Bay and up the peninsula, which fertilized the land values all along its route and created that super city. Meanwhile, it was taking so long to build, it took them 25 years to build that system, that within 5 years, the East Bay cities, Oakland, Berkeley, and Alameda, decided to go it alone, and they acquired water rights to the McCollumney River to the north, which had been formerly considered, and brought that water in within 5 years by gravity feed, by bringing it in through the Carquinez Strait area. So this was something I really didn't understand until I looked at a map and saw the service area of the Hetch Hetchy system and realized it's not just supplying San Francisco, it's supplying 2.5 million people in this extension of San Francisco outside of its own property lines, its own city limits. And that's exactly where the people who promoted the Hetch Hetchy Aqueduct had owned land, family estates, great estates which had been acquired in the 19th century and which imported water would only make phenomenally valuable if you could get it there, and particularly if you could get the public to pay for it. Because these great fortunes, in fact, I mean, you know, it's a myth that these are created by hard work and diligent free enterprise and everything. The greatest fortunes are made by tapping into the public treasury, sticking a tube in and sucking real hard. The public is generally never the wiser, that in fact they are vastly subsidizing private gain by means of increasing the value of arid real estate, either through aqueducts or through highways or public transit or whatever.
I found that really interesting, the public's role in both of these issues. In mining, it seemed that the public sort of inadvertently, up to this day, got stuck with the cost of mining that still expresses itself in Superfund sites and in mercury coming down every day into the bay. Water was already slightly different. There were bonds floated in order to finance this, and there was legislation necessary in order to get the eminent domain. So all of a sudden, the machinery of the state and tax money gets mobilized on an unprecedented scale.
Yes, and it's always couched in populist rhetoric. The people are going to profit from this. But in fact, what real estate people profit from this by bringing the water in. And I'm glad you mentioned the bonds, because they can't finance these things without selling bonds, which means that, of course, very wealthy dynasties, such as the Tevis family, whom I talk about a great deal, they were holding the bonds through the banks. The banks are profiting from this. And these long-term bonds, of course, are, as they say, safe as banks. And so that's another way to tap the treasury over the long term. And bonds, of course, proved enormously profitable to these people who also were controlling the water company and the land along the way. So the banks are profiting, the families behind the banks are profiting, the water company is profiting. You know, the public is essentially being reamed all along. They're paying the taxes, which are going to create these great systems. And the other great system, of course, is the Bureau of Reclamation. And that's what I really deal with in the book. And that was a tremendous revelation to me to find out why the Bureau of Reclamation was actually created.
That now extends the story beyond San Francisco and brings up the comparison to Los Angeles. Do I understand it right that the beneficiary of the founding of the Bureau of Reclamation, the first huge beneficiary was Los Angeles?
Well, that's, again, it's a compelling myth, which, of course, you see in dramatized in the movie Chinatown or Mark Reisner's great book, Cadillac Desert. The Bureau of Reclamation, or the Reclamation Service, was formed in 1902 by a congressional act. And it was formed, the enabling legislation was to bring publicly subsidized water to small family farms, owner-occupied on 160 acres. Great populist rhetoric. But the first act, in fact, was to take water away from the farmers in the Owens Valley on the east side of the Sierra Nevada and divert the Owens River about 250 miles southwest into an arid valley just outside of the city limits of Los Angeles called the San Fernando Valley, where major speculators such as Henry Huntington and the owners of the Los Angeles Times and others had already bought up the land because they knew the water was coming in. And they made a killing on that. They made a killing from the public subsidy of diverting this river away from the farmers to create a city. And that's what the Bureau of Reclamation has been doing ever since. Despite its enabling legislation to help small farmers, what the Bureau of Reclamation has morphed into is the greatest builder of cities that probably the country has ever known. And it's all through taxpayer subsidies. I mean, it's an amazing, I might even say an obscene perversion of the original intent of the National Reclamation Act. The first real project of the Reclamation Service is called the Newlands Project, and it was done in Nevada. It diverted the Truckee River into the Carson River Basin, a drainage area, to create small farms and alfalfa. And unbeknownst to many people, Newlands had invested the Sharon Estate money in desert lands in exactly the area that the Newlands Project delivered water to. And although much of that land was sold off to small family farms, the estate company was profiting from that. Another project was the Salt River Project, which diverted water from the Salt River to a dusty town in Arizona called Phoenix, where the Sharon family also owned large tracts of land, too. So you find that, in fact, the Bureau of Reclamation served these private and largely invisible land companies, in fact. And one of them was the founder of the Bureau of Reclamation.
I like the reference honoring the Paiute and reminding people that they lost their water in that process.
Yes. When the Truckee River was dammed, and the Truckee River is not a large river, it drains out, it's the sole outlet of Lake Tahoe, and it drains out and courses through the western Nevada desert and drains into a terminal lake called Pyramid Lake, a very beautiful desert lake. And that was where they had given the Paiutes an Indian reservation right there. And the Paiutes relied for their livelihood upon the fish in the river and the hunting along the river banks. And once the Truckee River was dammed and drained out of its bed into the Carson River drainage, of course, the river went dry in the Indian reservation. The lake began dropping. The fish all died. The Paiutes essentially were left high and dry and impoverished. But this has happened over and over again. The Indians really didn't have any say in the disposition of their own water, in fact. And there was a seasonal lake called Winnemucca Lake to the east of Pyramid. That went completely dry. It's just a salt flat now. So again, you have one of these dramatic environmental catastrophes, a sort of ecological collapse that resulted in order to divert water away and to turn it into capital on city markets somewhere else. The same thing happened in California's San Joaquin Valley, in the Central Valley, where there was a great ancient lake called Tulare Lake, the largest lake in California, which supported an enormous ecosystem. It was critical to the Pacific Flyway, to otters, to elk, beaver, etc. It was a great vortex of life. And when the San Francisco capitalists came into the valley, particularly Hagen and Tevis, who were partners with George Hearst, they wanted to irrigate their land, so they immediately diverted and cut off the rivers that fed into that lake, and it very quickly dried up. And today it's non-existent. It's just great platted fields which are now going out of production because of the accumulation of salt. There's virtually no sign that a great lake once existed on that location. As a matter of fact, it produces huge clouds of dust. But all the birds, all the life, everything that depended upon that is gone. And there was actually an eyewitness account of that in the 1890s when it went dry for the first time. And a man was there. He had trapped otters for money out in the lake. And he talked about how first the otters died and were left out on this salt pan. And then the raccoons moved in for the kill, and they just feasted on that until there was nothing left, and then they died too. And then, of course, all the birds vanished, and it essentially became a desert.
Let's go back to the San Francisco water system. Los Angeles had a fairly easy time annexing the Owens Valley and even had presidential agreement to it. But San Francisco had set its sight on a national park.
Well, yes, it was a former mayor named James Duval Phelan, who was a wealthy banker, an Irish-American banker, was one of the largest landholders in California at that time. And he realized that if San Francisco was to continue to grow, and he was very articulate. He loved giving public speeches and writing, and he always was writing about the imperial city and its destiny to become the greatest city in the Pacific, as long as it could get water. He realized that, you know, it couldn't do that without water. An engineer brought to his attention that there was a magnificent dam site in a glacial valley up in the Sierra about 1901. I don't think Phelan actually ever saw the place. He just saw photographs of it. And any engineer who saw this great granite tank with a bottleneck at its western mouth saw concrete in that bottleneck. Now, the only problem was that in 1890, Congress had declared that a national park. And once you throw a boundary around an area like that and declare it a national park, it becomes, in a secular society, the closest equivalent to holy territory, sacred space. So this immediately triggered off, you know, just a fury, a nationwide fury, that a national park was going to be invaded for this reservoir. And many people, including John Muir, who was one of the few white men who had seen the Hetch Hetchy Valley, compared Hetch Hetchy Valley to Yosemite Valley. But none of that meant anything to Phelan. He was a true utilitarian, a pragmatist. And it took him about 12 years to do it, fighting against Muir and the fledgling Sierra Club. It nearly destroyed the Sierra Club by splitting it, in fact, between the conservationists and the preservationists. But finally, just before Christmas in 1913, Phelan was successful, and Congress passed what was called the Raker Act, which gave San Francisco a unique variance to dam a river in a national park and to use it as its reservoir, not only for water, but for the production of electricity, provided that electricity would be wholesaled to the people in San Francisco. That also has never been honored, actually. That provision of the Raker Act has always been evaded because the city almost immediately sold that wholesale electricity to PG&E, which provides it at retail for the city. But anyway, the point is that San Francisco uses half of Yosemite National Park as its watershed to provide water for not only itself, but for all the people in the Hetch Hetchy service area around San Francisco Bay.
So if you were to take like the bird's eye, the satellite view of California and look at what the water reclamation, the water systems have done to the area, how would you describe what you can see now?
You would see what is probably the most thoroughly transformed natural landscape anywhere on the planet. because of these vast water systems, over 1,200 dams in California blocking virtually every major stream, river, creek, everything. That water is turned out of its beds. It is made to raise the value of real estate, to create cities, and in the process, cities and agribusiness transform the water itself. So the water, what water is finally turned back into the system has been thoroughly contaminated by the metabolic wastes of doing our business, of creating cities and agribusiness and all. And so you take pure water out and you put back a smaller amount of contaminated water. So it has devastated the ecosystems in California. And it's not only the visible water, it's also the invisible water, the groundwater in the aquifers, which have been are still being relentlessly pumped out. This is water which was built up over tens of thousands of years during the Pleistocene, which within the space of about 100 years has been pumped out to such an extent the parts of the San Joaquin Valley have dropped as much as 20, 30 feet. And this is permanent destruction of these water supplies. This is really groundwater mining. Those aquifers can never be replenished or restored once they've collapsed. So this is the legacy that we're passing on to our children, in fact. No fish, very few birds, no antelope, of course, except in very small preserves, and no water, fundamentally, no fresh water. We're creating a vast desert, an urbanized desert in California. And you can't say that we weren't warned, because, in fact, all of this was done thousands of years ago in Mesopotamia, in Syria, in China. Throughout the world, it's happened over and over again, but we never seem to learn from the lessons of the past. And we're doing it in California. We're just doing it much faster because our technology is so much more advanced than theirs was at that time. I wrote another book, which I collaborated on with a photographer, Robert Dawson. We traveled around California off and on for 5 years, driving and flying around the state to look at what was actually happening. Farewell Promised Land is kind of the what's happening. Imperial San Francisco is the why it's happening. A sort of, one is the disease and the other is the sort of diagnosis of the disease itself, and why we must be convinced, those of us on the ground must be convinced by those above us, that urban growth is inevitable and that cannot be stopped, because it's, of course, all for our own benefit. Well, it's not. It's for somebody else's benefit, really.
What could be done?
The only thing I can come up with at this point is that there has to be a far greater level of public knowledge of how these mistakes have been made over and over again, and about how we are doing it now to our own planet. We are essentially destroying our own home. Our George Perkins Marsh said this in his book in 1864. He said it was as if we were tearing the studs out of our house and burning the furniture and the wainscoting in order to seethe our porridge, and that obviously the results would not be very good in the end. Well, we're doing it very, very fast now. So what you need is an educated populace. And it's exactly what you're not getting. We're going in the opposite direction, because entertainment, media has essentially become propaganda through the medium of entertainment, and it's to divert people from these disturbing connections, in fact. So we're getting a less and less educated populace as the media is increasingly concentrated and devoted to getting people to consume more and more, and to increasing more all the time. So what we have to do is to fight for every independent, non-corporate media outlet that we had. And that means, I think, taking back public television, public broadcasting. People have to be made aware of what was stolen from them in the 1980s and 90s, and to organize to take it back so that we can, in fact, educate ourselves to things that we might not want to know, because much of this is very, very disturbing. But what we must know in order to find solutions to it. But I wanted also to illustrate certain ideas of my mentor, Lewis Mumford, who is, I think, one of the great thinkers of the 20th century. And unfortunately, not very many people read him anymore. But Marx was one of the great thinkers of the 19th century. Mumford was one of the great thinkers of the 20th century, because he taught us to see cities ecologically. And we must do that. You know, there's a paradox in that the larger the city becomes, the more dependent it becomes on the natural world, but the less aware people are of that dependence. They just expect that you flip a switch and you get energy, you turn a faucet and you get water. Well, you have to begin thinking then about what happens at the other end of those lines. And that's what Mumford taught me to do, what he would teach anybody who reads him to do. And so part of the reason for writing the book is it's an homage to my mentor. And I wanted people to read Mumford. I still read Mumford all the time. You know, and he's such a volcano of ideas. I constantly get ideas from him, in fact. So really, it's kind of an illustration of Mumford's ideas and a warning of what's to come, because Mumford was always warning us about what's to come. And so much of what he warned us about has, in fact, come true.
Which ones of his many, many books do you recommend?
The one that influenced me the most, I think, there are two, The City and History, in which he's constantly pointing out that what was past is always present. And when we're reading about Rome, we're really reading about now, and that there's much to be learned from the past. But the other one is The Pentagon of Power, and he wrote that at the time of the Vietnam War. He was one of the first of the great intellectuals to come out against the war and to point out that this was the mega machine, as he called it, in operation, the union of great corporations and large business, the worship of the machine, to create enormous environmental and social destruction. And he denounced it early on, long before many other people were doing so. But he also saw it as finally rolling towards our own global destruction, whether through environmental destruction or through instant annihilation, through the release of thermonuclear weapons. He felt that the mega machine was the first machine that cities had created, that kings and emperors had created, and we weren't aware of it because, in fact, it's an invisible machine. It's created out of human bodies, carefully inculcated with unifying thoughts by those who control the flood of information. And I think the same is true today. He saw it being rebuilt today, and I think that it's very true. It has been rebuilt. It's much more powerful now than ever before. We worship the machine exactly as he warned us that we shouldn't.
That was a conversation with Dr. Gray Brecken, the author of Imperial San Francisco. Brecken is also the author of Farewell Promised Land. You heard an interview I recorded in late 2000. Meanwhile, Brecken's book, Imperial San Francisco, has become a classic of urban studies and was republished in 2006. He is visiting scholar in the UC Berkeley Department of Geography and has embarked on a new project. He and a team of researchers have spent years chronicling the often forgotten works of the 1930s New Deal. The Living New Deal Project is the record of a lost society of a once intensely public-spirited America. Gray Brecken received a PhD in geography from the University of California at Berkeley. You can follow Gray Brecken on his website at graybrecken.net. That's one word, graybrechin.net. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation on TUC's website keeps this program on the air. That's tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gleiden. Thank you for listening.